You got this, so I can't get the other. Every time I go to the full screen, it loses that formatting. So the scriptures invite us to give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love, his wonderful deeds for humankind. He satisfies the thirsty, fills the hungry with good things. I think we've done that already this morning, but it's interesting that this psalm, it's Psalm 107, covered up by my toolbar there. It's actually a psalm that tells four stories in it that are kind of representative, and they're all pretty desperate crisis kind of stories. Like, it's people in real desolation, and at least one or two of them, it's like they've made their own mess there. It's kind of, they've done stuff that's really contributed to where they're going, and other times it seems like it's a little more, quote, random. But this is the refrain of the song, is the worship chorus. Letting the thanks for his unfailing love, his wonderful deeds for men, and then it usually finishes off with a slightly different refrain at the ending. So what I'd encourage us to do is just, even with the prompting of this little video that's coming up, it's not the one I shared earlier, it's another one. It just encourages us to start small and to be thankful to God for little things. So let's just consider this and enjoy this together.
It's so bright out, I can't feel a thing. Who we are now,
we are now.
I'm certainly grateful for this Thanksgiving, as where I was a year ago this weekend, was not someplace I expected to be. And I did send a picture to a few of you just randomly. I couldn't send it to everybody, but just got a chance to be in the same forest that the family was in last year, and they took these beautiful pictures of kids, Mary, and daughters, and grandkids. And it was lovely because it meant so much to me to at least be able to see that, what they were enjoying while I was in the hospital. But just to be able to be there yesterday was an extraordinary gift. I've just been pinching myself all week. I was pinching myself day of all the way up to the retreat, thinking I couldn't have seen myself even doing that in the depths of some of feeling overwhelmed by stuff. And it's just like there's so much to be grateful for, even in the midst of the struggle, the pain, the loss. We're going to talk a little bit today about, you know, wrestling with life's realities in a broken world. This faith is not an easy faith. We'll quote our friend Brad Jerzak, he says, when you think there's maybe easy grace or easy, that's not easy. It costs somebody everything. And it costs us sometimes a lot to hang in there. When it's loved ones we see struggling, personal, physical struggles we're going through, emotional, mental health, whatever it might be. But I believe we have hope, and I just know that we have to continue to cultivate that spirit of gratitude. And I get so forgetful. I get so full of complaining. First world stuff, I mean, really, like the stuff that we complain about. Many of you know that this world has just been thrown into a whole fresh round of chaos, and there's lots more pain and suffering going on every day, everywhere around the world. It has been in the extreme poverty of the global south, and just systemic injustice that's, you know, nation states that have been horrifically done. But, you know, we do get it blown wide open for us in the realities of tensions that erupt in places like Israel and Gaza. I don't know what you saw on the news or how much you shielded yourself or didn't, but, you know, I kind of had a busy full day yesterday with family and just caught a little bit of it yesterday morning before the whole day was away. And it wasn't until later last night I got, oh my gosh, here we go. This is certainly a deeper one. This is not just a little escalation. This is the eruption of just deep, violent hatred of one side. And yes, Israel has to carry its own responsibility for the things that systemically maybe they have done over the years, but it doesn't ever justify the actions of these who just murdered so many in cold blood. So, but the complexity of evil and the reality of life in a broken world is, I don't know, do you ever get a little bit overwhelmed with that? Does that ever just leave you perplexed? You know, Celine figured this one out in the old lens of the prophecies of the end times. So, right? I mean, our old narratives did what with the end times? What was the magic solution? Come on.
What do you mean?
Well, what was the magic resolution to
the
end time? Yeah, okay,
yes.
keep going. Yeah. What was the magic resolution?
Jesus come back and everything would be great, yeah.
And how would he come back? What way would he come back? What imagery did we conjure up from Revelation?
Some like the glory, yeah, and the conqueror. And
sword drawn, Battle of Armageddon is interpreted as what? God putting to death and his enemies. Hang on, who the heck is not his enemy? Paul says we are all the enemies of God. We're all aligned by nature and by choice, even though it's a choice out of the bondage of our will, but it's still out of our own actions. We've been aligned against God. So who do we think is nuts? Wouldn't be in those gun sights of that worldview. It's just like, really? Anyway, sorry. But isn't it interesting that there was kind of almost like a magical solution? But I don't think this God is into magical solutions the same way. I think this God is supernaturally, powerfully able to do more than we can all ask or imagine, but there's going to be a way that this God works in the world. And I think as we try to mature in this frame and understanding the way and the nature and way of divine love, and then our participation in that, it should lead us a little different direction than perhaps the old frame, and certainly even those today that, oh, this is hastening Armageddon. There's actually people cheering this on in conservative evangelical movements, hastening their perception of this is going to bring the millennium in, and we're going to get, like, they literally are cheering on this. You know, you see the sad picture of some of the Palestinian extremists, the Hamas, just cheering in places all over the world. In London, there was cheering, you know, that Israel was finally suffering and death and had been inflicted on it. And that same thing can happen. I saw celebrations in certain Western countries when certain leaders went down and, you know, were killed. And yes, there's horror, but as someone said, as people, you know, we do need to never minimize what's going on in any circle. We need to have deep empathy without excuse, and yet we can't miss the planks in our own eyes on some of these things, right? So we just got, there's a wisdom, there's a humility, there's a, I think, something that is asked of us that sometimes we just don't recognize in the complexity of the situation. Anyone have any other things they want to jump in and say at this point? Any of you feel a little disheartened after the news?
I missed the news. This is new to me.
It's basically the worst conflict in 50 years they've had in the Middle East.
So is it like shell and bullets going over?
No. Hamas actually invaded, slaughtered hundreds of Israelis in cold blood, women, children, took captives back and are holding them hostage. Somehow a great failure, because they're saying Netanyahu and others are having to wear massive failure in intelligence. But it's like they're 9/11. Something of that caliber happened to them that they just didn't see coming, and they literally came across on walking, on running, and you know, very, very modest means, plus the rockets and stuff. This is not just one of these incursions.
You'd sort of been hearing about the, like, anti-Semitism. That's been going up the last year or so. Like, there's been much more, they're saying that online, it's been a large increase in that.
And it's actually happening a lot in, increasingly, some of the media streams in the West are highly influenced by, I'll give them the benefit of some sincere intentions, but completely misguided assumptions that this is all Israel's fault because of Israel's done, I think, things that are unconscionable. Yeah. But it's no violence is ever, in a sense, the fault. It's like blaming it's just, anyway, the complexity of it is to be acknowledged. But this is of a different magnitude than almost anything else that's happened, and particularly, you know, the kind of, you know, it's really forcing now, it would seem, Israel into an all-out extended war to go after Hamas and others. And we just know that the collateral damage of that is going to be horrific.
Would this be any connection to the general uptick in young men in general around the world joining Muslim?
Certainly,
going with that faith in general, like supposedly there's a bit of an uptick in that too.
I mean, I think there's been a pretty good factory at work for years to create a radicalization, and maybe there's been an uptick in it, but it didn't seem to take too much to finally. I mean, this is revealing what Hamas has believed all along, that Israel has no right to exist at all. Period. Forget a two-state solution or anything. It's a deep, fundamental anti-Semitic view that the Jews should be exterminated. So you think about, you know, for thousands of years, Israel, Jewish people have struggled with this kind of a dynamic. And then, sadly, in the West, you know, a synagogue here, you know, people get slaughtered in the synagogue. It makes way less headlines than a particular person of color being killed in other situations. And that's just such a... Both are bad, but there's actually, well, it doesn't count as much, or somehow they asked for it. It's like, really? You know, so it's, again, without getting too much into the complexity of it, Chris, but there's this is the world we're in. And
you think it's time for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, well, I don't know, because they wouldn't probably be dialed into the West, because American Thanksgiving would be the one they'd care more about. They'd want to disrupt American
news. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Not ours. I think it's just an opportune thing, and for whatever reason, it's... Now is the time. It did come on the tail end, like they're just finishing up one of their holy seasons in Israel and in the Jewish faith right now. It was sort of a small holiday or small end of their, one of their, I guess it's the Feast of Tabernacles, right?
Sukkot.
Sukkot, yeah.
What's
it called, David?
It's called Sukkot.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the Feast of Tabernacles, we would call it in English.
They remember the pilgrimage.
Yeah. Uh-huh. David, you got some friends who've already been to you on this, some people that you know? And
I haven't talked to them, no, because most of them are off work all last week.
Right, yeah, exactly. And again, this is just, I think, encouraging us to have that kind of care and concern. It should, our spirits should be troubled by what we see any place around the world, whether it's, you know, Hutus and Tutsis or whatever this kind of just unthinkable ethnic-driven violence happens. And it can happen on small scale, you know, it can happen on large scale. Ironically, again, I'm off, been off Twitter for quite a long time now. But you see enough of it in a few other, a little more acceptable social media platforms. You know, one of the great advocates for trying to be more considerate of certain people of color who struggle with rates of crime and criminal activity gets literally knifed to death by street youth who are, you know, who are, and the person somehow, now the left doesn't want to even prosecute the people who killed them, who slaughtered them in cold blood, because they think that's somehow a racist thing to do. You're going, no, there are all kinds of issues of systemic racism we can get to, but you can't lose the plot in those kinds of ways. And we can lose the plot in these things, and they don't realize, well, why won't that ultimately come back on us? So the very attitudes that we carry, this is why Jesus says, you can't, you know, be pulling the speck out of your brother's eyes and moat your, you can't have a spirit of unforgiveness toward one, because it's going to come back towards you. There is a way, I think, for us to try to find, I'm going to suggest here, a path through. But the questions it raised for me, I don't know about you, is like, you know, so does this not come back to one of the great deep questions? You know, if this God is love, and if his way in the world is a way of love, then he's a good God. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. Great. We affirmed the verse. We sang the song. What's going on?
I mean, we're outside the garden.
That's an interesting way to start it. Anyone want to throw some thoughts in here? Do you wrestle with this at all?
Yeah, all the time.
I wrestle less and less with it, because to me it poses a bigger question, which is the assumption, there's got to be two sides of that assumption, and that is that God's in control.
Good stuff there, keep going.
Yep. So I wrestle with it less and less because I stop and realize how infinitely, I always think of God's love as great, but I think of God, how infinitely even greater to be all-knowing and yet choose to not be a puppet master, to actually give his children control, the right to choose, the right to decide, the right to dictate their actions, and probably not realizing the consequences thereof in any way, shape, and form, including, you know, what we carried out and even inventing a cross, never mind putting Jesus on it, you know, the epitome of that, but... yeah, I mean, Paul Young wrestles with it very well, and there's almost an amazingly sense of freedom and fear that comes along with that, because what a great responsibility Daddy has given us to tend for the garden. And so he has given us authority over the earth. He has given us the responsibility to care for the garden. He has not... exercise the spirit of control, and it's a subject, just quickly, even my own sister and I had a great conversation about it, because she was so mad at God that her husband Brad was suffering, not getting a job, kept going for job interviews, and why wouldn't God allow Brad to be chosen over the other person, and it was a great question.
Yeah.
And then I just said to her, so, you know, what you're saying is you're asking God to choose Brad over his other son. And that just takes me back to the amazing movie The Shack, where, you know, the judgment scene. And it's I don't know, like, you know, again, it's a really weird thought to say God's not in control, but I said to my sister, what if God's not in control? Because if he was in control, he'd be making choices. We're all puppets, so they basically he'd be manipulating that person to choose Brad over his other son. And I said, God's not going to do that. Like, that's the greatest act of love, is to not be in control and let his kids reign, which goes all the way back to the garden. And there's a sense of both fear and freedom that comes in that, because it's a lot easier to say God's in control, because it's a lot easier to blame one omnipresent being and say, well, it's all your fault. And then we're right? We're forgiven. I mean, you know, sins are forgiven. So we get free reign, and yet our responsibility that Daddy's given us is just out the window.
I feel like I should pull up the adjustment error clip, because you're absolutely bang on, David, mm-hmm. in terms of that. There's the clip I got ends with the guy saying, well, the Adjustment Bureau sort of, I don't know, he's one of the high guys up at the Adjustment Bureau. Do you remember the Adjustment Bureau movie reference I've made? Have you actually seen the movie, Dave?
Yeah, I've seen it a number of times, yeah. And I love it. I just want to be really careful here, because when I say that God's not in control,
yes.
there's actually an elevation to me. When I say that, there's an elevation of my father. Like, I don't believe there's a diminishing.
Yes, agree.
Because some people, I know that some people, and my sister will back at me too, and she should, because after years and years and years and years of praying, like God's in control, which is asking God to be manipulative, when you change that, you actually realize how awesome God is and how awesome His love is to actually take that position. It's not a diminishing, it's actually an elevation.
Something that really helped me was 100%. The difference between saying God's in control, what you were raised with, and understanding He's in charge. And it's like a parent who's in charge of their kids, but you can't be controlling everything they do every moment in their decisions. And since I grasped that, to just say God is in charge, but He's not gonna control us. Mm-hmm. And that's so reassuring, so beautiful. As opposed to, I think if I was ever told God isn't in charge years ago, that would have made me feel like scared. So, oh, He's not in control. I always thought He was, and that used to bring peace. But now I'm like, oh no, I see it's actually not, it doesn't bring peace, and it's not what we want. We don't want to be controlled by God, but He's in charge, and He loves us, and He cares for us, and He allows us to make our choices. Because He loves us, so.
And the again, we all use words differently. So totally. That may be a way that you're creating that in charge as being your parameter is that God's not powerless. But what is God choosing to do? Like Jesus isn't powerless before Pilate. You would have no authority were not given you. But this God submits to our choices, to our being out of our minds sometimes. It's the very nature of the garden. It's the very nature of creating a universe where love as a free response of sentient beings is possible. Because it also means it's possible to choose that which is destructive.
And our choice doesn't change His choice.
Correct. It doesn't change
His choice. His choice is to never leave us or forsake us, right? Yeah. Just because you don't think I'm there doesn't mean that I'm not there, right? You can make that choice,
absolutely.
But I'm not moving.
Yeah. And it really, what I think you're trying to help us do, David, it's really important, and this is, I think, where we're going, is we continue to come back to, this is fundamentally about the nature and character of God. Who is God? What is He really like, and how does He work and move, and how do we live and move and have our being inside the nature of this God, and what is actually we're expressing about? Our old frame would have said what? Nope, we're going to get on the side of, well, especially when we had this rather blindness about Israel doing no wrong. And, you know, I think, like, there's a holy land. Well, the whole earth is actually holy. And if you recognize sacred presence, it isn't to mean that we should be uncaring about legitimate human rights, but it's human rights for both peoples. And you know, you think about any story of history, it's just whoever wins gets to tell the story and gets to occupy the land, right? So, sorry, but if things had switched otherwise, man in the high castle, you know, it's like, whoa, well, guess what you get to learn, and, you know, it's there's so many layers to this, but it all comes down to, well, who is this God? What is this God like? Jesus did not come to change the mind of God about humanity. He came to change the mind of humanity about God, and and Trinity's continually working with us. And for me, these are moments where we wrestle with those things, and it when you dig down and you get right to the core, it's exactly the kind of thing that you're speaking to, Dave, and it uncovers what we implicitly believe. And it's certainly understandable others come. I would like to God. There's enough times in the last 3 or 4 years. Jesus, I want the white horse, God. I want the white horse, Jesus, to come in, because I just want you to get the stuff sorted. I'm sick and tired. And then I realized, hang on, if the Word who had a beard and, you know, lived and, you know, on earth actually comes with that sword and divides joint and marrow, it's actually dividing a mean joint and marrow. There's no sword I'm going to escape from. If I want this Jesus to come back with the sword, it'll be the surgeon's scalpel. If I see it right, it'll be the loving, incisive, essential work of a divine physician who has my good, a good shepherd. but it will never be against my will, and that's the key thing we're talking about. And it won't be without our participation. So, tons of great questions you're raising on this. This is so fun. So, something you had a thought.
I just want to say one thing.
Yeah.
The fear and the freedom that you were talking about, Dave, I guess. I mean, most people, the whole concept of God is that we want him to be in control, but we don't want, we want him to be, we want that control because it's a security piece.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult to separate. Particularly, I find that very difficult to separate. You know, I want God to be the white horse God, but I also want him to be the one that I can look to and say that he is perfect and beautiful and will not override me. So it's like I want my cake and eat it, you know. It's just like you say, you have to start taking responsibility, because God, everybody blames God for everything. It's very simple, right? I mean, oh yeah, well, how could you possibly? I mean, I listen to that daily, and in the environment that I'm in, you know, and the people I connect with, and so I constantly say, you know, to myself, you know, that's such a lie. It's such a lie, and yet we all buy into it at some level.
It requires the crisis that the longing for control, which gives us this known and sort of safer universe. We want the silo. We want the safety of the silo with the pack, with its clear defined rules. And if there's something outside the silo, we don't want to. This is the Apple TV Plus series that I was just raving about recently. You'll see some clips coming from it soon. It's just like, yes, there's a comfort, there's a viability to living life inside that, but it's greatly diminished, and you're not going to become authentically human and fully alive in that space, because to become authentically human and fully alive, you actually are thrown back with a measure of freedom that scares the hell out of you. What if it actually is, what if I'm actually free to choose and make, and actually might suffer the consequences? But is there a deeper dynamic at work that we can learn to turn our, to, we can entrust ourselves to? And that's the whole question that we come to. There's these promises about, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, right? His name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. The next verse says, of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, and to order and establish it with judgment, from that time on, even forward, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. That sounds like the power God coming in. But what if the zeal of God is the zeal of uncontrolling love, the vulnerability of
there's the catch.
Of exactly, descending into our human experience and literally taking it all on. Going to the bottom of all that's darkened in our understanding, all that's broken. And so, you know, if God loves wins, well, does it really? Like, if so, why does it take so long? If love wins, how do we know? How does it happen? What kind of love ultimately wins?
I think we even used to, I used to believe, I don't know if I was even told or just mistakenly thought it, but you come to Christ, and then you're going to be, you can pray for protection, you pray for the blood of Jesus on you, and, you know, you're Christians, and you're kind of in this safe place, and the bad things shouldn't happen to us. And then as you mature as a Christian, it's like, oh, hard things do happen, and, well, you know, I'm a Christian, and I was praying for safety, and I was praying for protection, and then you start understanding, and even all the new stuff you've been teaching us, I'm like, wait, God loves everyone the same, and so that whole suffering piece is, it seems almost in conflict to what we think, that we can create that protection upon ourselves, but there is suffering,
yes,
it is real, yes. And it's going to be upon everyone in the world, not just, you know, I mean, everyone to be a Christian. It's like, oh yeah, if you become a Christian, nothing bad happens to you. But, like, that wouldn't...
I was charter member in that wonderful, illusionary world.
Right, and it's very dangerous until you find...
I had a massive crisis of faith a couple years into my Christian life, because all my formulaic, I read my Bible, prayed every day, and I was going to grow, right?
Yeah,
I know that song, right?
Yeah, that's what I think.
And I did all my memorization. I served God as zealously as anyone could. I was Saul of Tarsus, just with a Christian sort of angle on it. And guess what? Life doesn't work out like that. There's just, I came crashing down on the well, what did I do? I must have done something wrong, yeah, or God must not be good. Those were the only two conclusions I could come to in my immaturity. And man, oh man, I went through like serious years of dark night of the soul and a long, slow recovery until love broke through and challenged me to rethink some of those assumptions, which has been 30 plus years, you know, ongoing. But
well, there's also a huge breaking of offering through performance. Like, what do I have to do to, you know,
earn love?
But also to stay in the silo of protection.
Right.
Right? Like, I didn't do enough devotions that day, so now I'm outside of the silo of protection. I didn't read my Bible that week, I'm outside the silo. So it's always like getting back into the silo of protection. And so there's going to be a car accident. It's not like God's turning around, you know, with Tonka toys and saying, okay, we're going to, well, oh, Dave's in that car, so I'm going to sacrifice that car. And it's like going, really? Like, it's just...
It's so difficult because, you know, there seems to be those times in Scripture and in Jesus' life. So let's put it in Jesus' life. Let's not get stuck up in Job's story, which is, you know, really just a wisdom story. It's like God's not making deals with the devil. And it's actually a parable. It has lessons to be learned, but it's not to be taken, I think, as a literal correspondence that God like likes to sort of put you and I up as wager pieces in some cosmic game like the ancient Greek gods did, right? You know, that's what the Greek gods did. They actually set up these, you know, sort of theoretical mind games as the gods, and then had subjects on earth. Wonder what Job might be intending to try to parallel. Anyway, just a little sidebar there. But it really does, it's really challenging because it seems that there is some way in which our participation by faith in the true way of love might actually, this is where I'm giving you a nod here, Celine, like there's times when this seems to, quote, make a difference in outcome.
If you believe in prayer, you have to believe that it can make a difference.
Right? The prayers of a fervent person are effectual and comfortable, right? So there's a mystery here.
What are you praying to? Are you praying to a God who's in control?
Yep.
Or are you praying to a God who zealously will act in his heart under his understanding of governance and what that means? And governance is the empowering of the people type of idea.
Sure.
Right? Like, which God are you praying to?
But we got some pretty good, at least we think it's reasonably authentic stories in the book of Acts where the church is gathered praying, it's a persecutor church, and earthquake happens, angels show up, and prison doors get knocked open. Now, that ain't a normal way of being, but still, God only rarely, it seems, suspends the normal sort of dynamics of operation. And even that suspension isn't a zero-sum game because it's not putting someone else to death. It's actually something that seems to working through a purpose, but you see, Dave, I'm with you. You could fall off really quickly onto the other side. But God, so I'm speaking and doing this for you. This little side's for you.
Yeah, well, God could have helped with the Blue Jays. I mean,
people make decisions.
That's right.
Praying for the other team. It's like,
that's right, exactly. It is hilarious. Prayer. Both teams praying.
Wins.
Hey, end of the game field goal. Both teams are huddled in prayer on the sideline. And you go,
what's God to
guys, do? Really?
Who gets the side?
That we think God's
anointing was on Rios, and Schneider pulled him out.
Exactly.
Right. Schneider was the enemy, and he pulled him out.
He just didn't have enough wisdom, those prayers. But it is. We should be able to laugh and just sort of step back and enjoy the fact that it is a dynamic universe, and it is a contingent universe, and those are the two things to still hold together. I don't understand almost the interplay of those things. So I'm not going to say that when I say God, God is in control. It's like I don't even use that word anymore, simply because it's just has so many negative connotations. God is actively engaged with us, co-creating, co-redeeming, co-healing. There's a way in which I'm trying to find to give expression to this, but particularly as it comes from the nature of God and the questions that I kind of threw up on these rhetorical questions. Well, of course we believe God's love wins, but it's the how, and it is the view, the long view. Would the love of God be considered to have won if even a single of his creatures in all eternity still choose to live in self-imposed darkness, blindness, and the torment of that, which I think is hell? It's not God putting that hell on them, it's them resisting. Would God's love have won? I don't think we have to reduce it to some kind of a artificial scoreboard thing. But I believe now that I didn't 15, 20 years ago, God's love will not relent and will not let go and will not give up on any one of us, just like I would never give up on any of my kids, and am I better than God? And so the possibility is that, of course, God's love wins, but never against our wills and never without our participation. And our friend George MacDonald, he nails it, and it ripped my heart at the first time. I think it's his unspoken sermon called The Last Farthing. You know that parable from the King James? I tell you the truth, this person won't be let out of the debtor's prison until he's paid back the last farthing. That sounds like a pretty vengeful God, right? But the whole spirit of that parable, in my mind, is that unforgiveness is so essential to the way of love, because it's never deserved, that if you harbor the spirit of unforgiveness, you are locking yourself in a prison of your own making. That bitterness is going to eat you up, and it's going to be like worms. It's going to be like fire just burning against the truth of your being. And so guess what? You won't be able to escape that torment until you learn what this self-giving, radically forgiving, co-suffering love is like. And MacDonald says, and which one of us, having tasted and experienced this love in the age to come, unveiled, I'm paraphrasing it, but with unveiled face, could ever be content to enjoy that and not immediately go if there was even one who was outside the city, if it were outside and suffering of their own foolishness and blindness? I tell you, unless you're willing to go and sit with that person, you don't know anything about this love. And they're going, holy crap. So that's a different order of the way of love. That's not about the controlling, vengeful God. That's redemptive, gracious, the healing and restoration of all. That's actually what the justice of God is better defined as. He won't rest till everything that is broken and out of alignment with the way of love is healed and restored, because that's what justice is. It's not punishing the guy who killed Missy. It's Missy's perpetrator, Missy's the violent man, the deranged man, being healed and restored, and Missy being given back. That's right in the shack. That's what justice is. And so when Mac is tempted to sit on the seat and he realizes he's impossibly conflicted, you can't do this. To me, the only arc in story, the only meta-narrative, is this one of a love that we can't even begin to fathom. No eye has seen, nor ears heard. It blows our minds. And you know the depth of this love, Paul prays, height, width, and which surpasses knowledge, so that you might actually experientially be increasingly filled with this, such that it transforms you and I and everyone. And then he ends with a great benediction: to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we can ask or imagine, according to his power at work within us. That sounds like participation. So it's got to come from a source outside ourselves. You're the vine, I'm the branch. It can't be something that we just sort of generate on our own. So there's this beautiful interdependency. But that God's power, through the weakness of our flesh, through the weakness of cruciform love, will be unveiled. We've already had a great conversation on my clock out here. We've only got a few more minutes, but I just was going to pull up the juxtaposition of Psalm 46. Well, hang on. Message translation of verses 8 through 11. Right, this is the one that ends, "Be still and know that I am God." But here's the verses around it, right now. So, see how God brings to, bands wars from pole to pole, breaks all the weapons across his knee. Step out of the traffic, take a long, loving look at your high God, above politics, above everything. I just love how Peterson renders that. Jacob wrestling God fights for us. God of angel armies protects us. That's how the psalm ends. So, step out of the traffic, take a long, loving look at me. That's be still and know that I am God. Well, this is an aspirational psalm, I guess you'd have to say, because the way that this God's going to make wars cease to the end of the earth is entirely different. I'll send you these slides, but I just pulled out one quote from Brad. Again, I was going a little different direction, and I got up this morning and just the news pushed me to. So I just threw some of these together. You're not getting all fancy individualized graphics and stuff, so I think you can live with that. But it's about the divine solidarity. You're going to be able to live with that, Zab?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, he said I want my
title back. Exactly. Oh, Ron, can you forgive me for not having fresh graphics on every year in his life? Divine solidarity. This is what, again, it comes down to. This is a God who's actually, there's no human with whom Jesus does not stand. This starts to give me a bit of hope and comfort, hopefully for you, Sandra, and for all of us who are in times where we're close to pain and suffering. There's not one person, not one, against every hurled accusation, every derision, and all that mocks our existence, famine, decay, murder, disease, disaster, and death, human violence against one another. Jesus has our back. As always, Jesus stands with humanity and with every human person. That includes the people in Hamas who are out of the mines, and or the people of Israel who maybe have filled with retributive violence right now. You know, it, just again, make sure that we see it, the all is all of us here. Against all that accuses and belittles us and seeks to destroy us, and he does this as our human brother and as God. This is the way that God is transforming, not from on high, but from within, entering into everything that we share. Brad goes on to describe what Kenneth Tanner had just quoted there. Sounds beautiful and inspiring and wonderful. I wish I had said it, but then I stumble. I remember the priests and the pedophiles. Forgiveness is not just radical. Forgiveness of the perp is the scandalous and nauseating F word. The real F word is forgiveness, right? And this is under a chapter in Brad's book, In, called Make Jesus Scandalous Again. And then I remember myself. Who am I? The sinner at Jesus' feet or the holy man bearing stones? What'll it be, Brad? Mercy or condemnation? What then? I pray for the victims of the clergy's many sins, mine included. I pray for the mercy of such deep-level healing that their cry for justice will transcend retribution and bring the true justice of a redeemed world. For perpetrators, I pray for the severe mercy of rigorous honesty, heart-rending repentance, appropriate penance, and real freedom to become more than what they are now. You see, it's not a God who lets us get away with things, because the good of the person who's the perpetrator, as well as the healing of the victim, are both equally in God's view. For myself, I pray, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner, and God, grant them the same mercy I want for myself. As God, to forgive the unforgivable and redeem the most perverse by his transforming mercy. Remember, when Brad says, Lord, we pray, Lord, have mercy, it's not because we're afraid this God isn't going to be merciful, but we're putting ourselves under the infinite flowing stream, the springs of his mercy. So it's like we're consciously positioning ourselves under the tap of God's mercy, and to pray for someone else is like pulling them under the flow with us. So picture the waterfall. You're stepping into it. Oh yeah, I'm going to bring this person. That's how Brad understands what it means to say, Lord, have mercy. It's not because God isn't merciful. So, but then the criticism comes back, well, that was too easy. But easy is not easy. One reason forgiveness becomes the F word is that we mistake it for a cheap get-out-of-jail-free card. Absolution sounds too easy, but no, it's not. Not for me, and especially not for Jesus, says Brad. Forgiveness is not easy. The passion, the torture and death and burden of our sin cost Christ everything. Forgiveness is not easy for those who've been devastated by the hurts and trespasses, the violation of others. And forgiveness is not easy for those who've long condemned themselves as unforgivable. It's hard to me to write about forgiveness. Seated on both sides of the terrible table of offense, whether fantasizing vengeance for the victims or empathizing with the offenders, forgiveness is the most demanding, excruciating process we'll ever experience. Forgiveness is cruciformity itself. Do you know what cruciformity is? Cruciform means cross-shaped, cross, sort of flavored, cross-like. The cruciform, the crucified, that's what cruciform means. So whatever it was, the cross of forgiveness is not easy, least of all for Jesus Christ. And so this is how love wins. This is how love wins. And sometimes I think that sucks. And sometimes I can't go there. You know, and I got more vengeance, or I got more demanding that it should be easier. And we still live in relatively extraordinary comfort and safety and ease here, as we were praying earlier. I mean, stuff we take for granted. My friends in Malawi, you know, they got corrupt governments all around them, and they got hardship, and the money that's being apparently sent to the Ukraine is, you know, some of it's going with the oligarchs right now, and, you know, the Ukrainian oligarchs. It's all over the world. Like, really? This God's actually going to work this thing out? There's a promise here to hold on to. Somehow Jesus gives us this assurance. My peace, or precedes this, the immediate verse that precedes this, my peace I give you. Not as the Lord gives. I give to you. So we're actually invited to share in Jesus' peace, his shalom. Somehow in Jesus, he is reconciling all things. He is making all things new, but it's still a long, long way to go.
But his problem, years.
Yes. Yes. As Baxter Kruger says, maybe we're still the early church. Yeah. We're still the early church. Isn't that just, what? No! But what if God actually has such, this is the control that God has over the universe. Are you this? His control is that he knows that love, ultimately, real love, will win the day, but not in a course of power game. But there is a way in which the control that God has relinquished over forcing an outcome is the confidence he has in the way of divine love. You watch it, what it does to Saul of Tarsus. And I gotta believe as he's putting James to death, and his, what it said, they're laying the clothes at the feet.
Stephen,
thank you. And
he was holding the cloak.
He was holding the cloaks. And somehow Stephen doesn't reply, well, we're gonna get you, just wait till we rise up in arms. There was this incredible transformative quality to Stephen's faith and his confidence. He saw beyond just the realm that is, the physical realm that was, not to diminish this realm, but there was a way he saw through. That had to get inside Saul's craw. There had to be a way which that was actually part of the process of the unveiling, the awakening that goes on for Saul of Tarsus. And you just never know what the power of that's going to do. A Hidden Life, one last movie reference. You probably will never watch it, but Terrence Malick's my favorite filmmaker. It's the power, I think I've told you, of this one man in Austria in pre-war Nazi Germany, as all the horrors and the discrimination, slow frog in the kettle kind of discrimination against Jewish people, but it just incrementally got worse and worse. And eventually in this village, you were required to go and do your 2 years of just kind of token military duty. You weren't going to go to the front lines. And you simply had to do this. You had to repeat an oath to Hitler. And he was the only one in the whole group of these rural farmers and others who didn't just go through the motions and just say the words. You don't have to mean them. Just say the words. And he wouldn't do it. And he held on to this integrity. And it's like, even his wife comes and says, I honor your integrity, and we don't like this guy, but you know, it's going to cost you your life. And you see this story unfold. And he's being berated, you know, in the months of his incarceration because he's refusing to recant and just, you know, say the words, and he gets out of jail. And he's sitting there, and he's holding on to his integrity. He says, I can't do this because they are me. If I do that, I ultimately am diminishing my own humanity. And he's got the ability to do this. And the prison guards, the Gestapo, are saying, your life, no one's even going to know whether you do this or not. You think your resistance here is going to do anything? This hidden life? Oh, I wish I could. I need to bring the quote up, and I won't have time to bring it up, but I'll put it in the slide. The quote that this guy cites from C.S. Eliot about the power of a hidden life can ripple and change the world far beyond anything we could imagine. There isn't anything hidden from the eyes of God, and ultimately, I believe this good, this way of love, is like good living. It will transform the world around us. We may not see its fruit immediately, but that's the ultimate faith challenge. Do I believe that? Lord, help my unbelief. I find it very hard, but that's how I see it.
But you ended with that, because when you asked the question, is like, you know, how will love win? And I always smile because Jesus never really answered questions. He asked another question. And I could just hear Jesus kind of going, so David, what do you mean by love? And what do you mean by win? And if you can define those two things, because it changes everything, right? Because the definition of winning is not what you just described. Right? Like that beautiful movie and what you just described so passionately, that wouldn't be our definition of winning.
So true. So true. Gotta make a note here to drop in the hidden life slide. Hidden life quote.